Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Welcome back to Hot Takes and Deep Dives, and I am here with casting producer Frank Garrity to take us behind the scenes of casting some of our favorite Bravo shows, like Below Deck Med and all of its spinoffs, The People's Couch, Blind Date, Millionaire Matchmaker, Tabitha's Salon Takeover. I can't wait to get into this. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Jess, thank you so much for having me today. I just want to tell you, I'm such a big fan. So this is a real honor to be doing this with you.
You're so sweet. You actually reached out to me nearly a year ago to like give me some like random tea about like Millionaire Matchmaker from 100 years ago. And I was like, do you want to come on the show? And there was a reason why you didn't nearly a year ago. And then, I don't know, you reached back out and I was like, hey, like you reached out for some reason.
Okay, no, I can tell you why I reached out.
Okay, tell me.
I reached out because I'm a fan. I just wanted to say, I think you had interviewed a friend and colleague of mine named Paige Hurwitz. I did some projects with Paige and Wanda Sykes that were fabulous. They're the best people I've ever worked with.
Paige Hurwitz produces all of the Netflix comedy specials, and she's Wanda Sykes' producing partner. And she was one of my favorite interviews that I did in the last 2 years.
So yeah, so I thought, you know, and I think I'd mentioned I was casting producer. And since a big wheelhouse of yours is Bravo TV, I think that piqued your interest.
I want to start with you. How did you become a casting producer to begin with?
I moved to LA in 2001. I wanted to work in film. And I did. I got a job. After a while of struggling around and looking for jobs, I was able to get a job on independent films, low budget indies. And I hated it. Hated it.
Like what? Any indies that we would know?
I worked on a really kind of a little cult classic called The Gene Generation, starring Bai Ling. Mm-hmm. Faye Dunaway was in it. And I did a couple like horror movies. The work part of it was really fun because I was a set decorator. And you're given full autonomy with low budgets to be as creative as you want and just go. When you work on higher budget films, you have a hierarchy and you can't even move a chair if it's a union project. If that's someone else's job. But that said, the hours are hideous and the pay as a PA, hideous. I was like, wow, this is a real game changer. What am I gonna, this is what I moved out here to do. Cut to, I knew a friend that worked in reality TV and it was sort of in its infancy. And he said, I think you'd be a really good casting director, producer for reality. I didn't know what that was. I don't know, maybe Survivor had just started.
What show was your friend working on?
He had done The Bachelor. Early seasons of it. His name is Mark Allen. And he hooked me up with the people on Blind Date. I don't know if people are going to remember. Blind Date was the first dating show.
Blind Date was on Bravo.
Was it?
I think so. I'm pretty sure Blind Date was on Bravo.
For people that might not remember, it was the ones, it had the thought bubbles coming over the daters' heads. And they were usually comedic. Each episode would have a date that went well and a date that didn't. Anyway, I interviewed these people like, you've never done this before. We need somebody. We're going to put you through. And I came in halfway through the casting season, which was maybe about 3 months, having never done it. And in the 6 weeks that I was there, I became the third most successful producer in getting people on the show. Mm-hmm. So they were like, whoa, you got the knack. And I just was lucky. And I'm lucky because I like people. But back in the day, this was MySpace. We used to have to find people through MySpace. So that's how long ago it was. Anyway, so that started my career. One show leads to another. You build a network. You meet people. I went from that to a Fox TV show. And then the real break was American Gladiators. And that led to all the Bravo projects.
Suppose somebody is like, my dream is to like be a Housewives casting producer. Like I have often like daydreamed, like I think I'd be like pretty good at that job. how would I or somebody like me, do you have to first get in with, say, Shed Media or World of Wonder or what? Suppose somebody wants to do casting for Drag Race. Yes. What is the in?
Okay, I can tell you there's a couple different ways. If you're young, green, don't have a network yet, which most of us don't at 21 or 22, I always tell people, go on the boards on Facebook. Facebook has, I need a casting director, I need a casting producer. I'm new, I'm hungry, I want to do this, I love reality TV. The best experience is starting on a dating show, The Bachelor, Bachelorette, Temptation Island, whatever, because you just have to find sexy singles and you're a recruiter. You just go out and find bodies that you think will be good, send them to the producers. If the producers go, oh, wow, Jessie's sending us good people, then they'll start moving you up. And then there's a, you know, that's a recruiter. Then you're an associate. Then you move up to a producer director. Someone like you who might have some, you know, life experience behind them say, I run in these circles. You would be sort of like, they would probably give you per diems like, hey, Jess, you know, you already know these people. So if you could sort of like cut to the front of the line and send us names, if we really like them, we, sometimes they'll give you a finder's fee. But sometimes they'll say, hey, maybe it's a side gig. I mean, I would say, it depends on what your situation is. Sometimes people can do it part time. It's a great, great job if you're looking for different avenues. So it does allow for some flexibility, because being a casting producer, director, recruiter, a lot of it now you can do from home.
Well, this actually springs to mind, like, how has casting changed? I imagine it's changed drastically from when you were doing the early days of Millionaire Matchmaker to cut to today. I know that a lot of people, for example, Drag Race, I know a lot, they're all being found on Instagram, TikTok. Like, it's all through social media.
Yes.
They want people who already have big followings. They don't want the undiscovered real people.
That's what's changed a lot. I mean, I will say you can still find people in person, because the best people, I would say bar none, that you see on reality TV, 9 times out of 10 had no plan on going on reality TV. They were someone like, how did you get a show? I don't know. My neighbor knew this guy and he was looking for people and he said, you should call me. And then I wasn't looking. That's almost always what happens when people are clamoring. If they get on, they're not that good. But they're also, I find, too conscious of what they think the viewers want to see.
That's the plague that afflicts Housewives. That's why Housewives is honestly unwatchable now.
Yes.
With Below Deck, are you casting the actual crew or the people who are like because I know that like the actual people who are going on the trips, they need to fully pay like $2,000 to like sit there. How much? What is it? Because I know friends of mine have gotten emails.
I don't cast the guests.
It's several. You have to pay several grand. I know this for a fact.
It's not inexpensive, but you do get a massive discount. I was working with the people that cast the crew, the regulars, the series regulars, the captains, the deckhands, the stews.
Like, what was the biggest name that you, like, I'm thinking of like Captain Sandy, Kate Chastain, Captain Lee. Where are these people? Because these are real captains. Where are these people being plucked from?
They were mostly word of mouth. I do know Captain Sandy told her story. There are less than 100 women on the planet that have the level of license needed to captain one of those yachts. Mm-hmm. So there aren't that many. And then to find people that might want to do it and everything, it gets very, it's not an easy test. They're out there, but a lot of people don't want to do it because, you know, hey, it's my career and I'm not sure. And that's totally understandable. And then a lot of people want to do it too badly and they're not going to be any good. So it's a real kind of, it's a game of finding that perfect balance of who's not so desperate, who's going to be good on camera, you know. So the deckhands and stews, what we always say is the younger they are, the sort of generally, it's never easy. It's less difficult to find. When you get up to the higher levels, the chief stews, the chefs, these are people that are professionals and there aren't as many of them. And when you find them, you know, it's like, say if there are 10,000 people that are a chief stew, maybe 2,000 might be interested. And those 2,000, who's going to be good on TV? So it just whittles itself down.
So tell me like the whittling down process. Like what sorts of things are you asking them? Let's focus on Below Deck just for this example. Like what are you asking them?
Well, obviously, if you know the show, a lot of it's about dating. So they do want, in a perfect world, they'd love to see the cast members single. They want the romance to be real. They want the audience to root for a couple.
People who are legitimately available. Can you talk about the relationship between a casting producer director like you and, say, the show producer? We can use Below Deck as an example, or even like Housewives. What is that relationship like? Because you're finding the people and then the show producer is actually in the thick of it with the person day to day.
What I start with, I'm going to give probably the story producer and the showrunner, the executive producer, I'm going to give you a solid outline for the show and you're going to write the book. So I find these great characters and I'm going to say, Jess is going to be on the show. Here's some great story points you might be able to mine throughout the season. Because there is a show Bible written up for every episode with a huge disclaimer. By no means can we guarantee this is going to happen.
Wait, for every episode or for every show?
For every episode. Yeah, there's like
every
a little,
episode.
Like an episode Bible. Yeah, they'll know, like on the Housewives, they know that we're going to put them, so-and-so's having a white party.
Right.
And what are we going to see happen at the white party? We don't know, but we know that Sonia's in a fight with Bethany or whatever. And the night before that, they're having dinner together. So something might happen at dinner. So at the party the next night. So it's all speculative, but there is prodding. You know, hey, you know what, Jess? You got to go talk to Bethany today about what happened last night. And then the rest is real. That's as script as it might get, but in a sort of produced Bible, it will say, we can't guarantee this is happening, but a really important job of a good casting producer is knowing you as well as we can. I will talk to the cast members every day for 6 months before we shoot. Just shoot the shit. Hey, Jess, what are you doing? What's up? How are you doing? And I kind of get a feel for who you are. And like, you know your friends, you know how they're probably going to react in a certain situation. So I could gauge that. And it's usually pretty accurate. For the most part, I like to say, we give you the outline, you write the book. So they're going to have all the notes and say, now we got to make this stuff happen and make it really rich and exciting. Does that make sense?
Oh, totally. I know that for shows like Vanderpump Rules and Summer House, the ones that are kind of like the you know, not quite housewives, more like groups of friends, they will say like, okay, here are like historical relationships, like say Lindsay and Everett dated, or like Carl in the past dated XYZ, Jax in the past dated Stassi. All of that history has to already be documented. And then they can kind of write the script, so to speak, of what may happen.
Yes.
And then it's the producer's job to kind of
nudge it along.
Nudge it along.
You know, we can nudge it along, but they don't. They're not going to. I mean, okay, I'm not going to. I was on one project. It was a game changer for me because the people running it just did. We just didn't see eye to eye. And they were telling people what to say, what to do. Everything was made up from whole cloth. And it was really disappointing because I'd worked so hard and they were literally telling people what to say off camera. And let's just say I only worked one season on that show.
Once a show goes into production, is the casting director, the casting producer still in the mix? Like,
the smart ones keep us around. Yes. Because what they found out, budget for the casting producer, director, someone from casting, because put it this way, I know all these people from Below Deck, say that whatever they're starting on. They all arrive. They don't know anybody. They don't know the producers, the directors, the cameramen. And sometimes they can shut down. You need someone they've already bonded with just to make them feel comfortable. Oh, because it's nerve-wracking. These people have never been on TV. So the smart people will say, can you stick around? Be on set. Frank's in with these people. He makes my job a lot easier to just have a linear line of communication. So the people that are really high in charge, from my experience, want to stay back as much as they can and let this play out. But sometimes you do need me or someone who knows these people to facilitate. I mean, there's going to be a meltdown. Someone's going to get pissed off. Someone's not going to want to show up. Somebody's tired. Someone's hungover, whatever. Someone's in a fight. I'm not doing that, you know, and it's just. So the communication, if they don't have that, it just makes everyone's job so much harder. And, you know, things are changing. If I've noticed it happened on the set of that movie where Alec Baldwin allegedly shot. The hours were outrageous and they were like working and the union quit. And I think that's catching up. No one wants to work 16, 18 hours a day, nor should you. So when you have a really good line of communication, you shouldn't have to work long days like that. You know, I always think 12-hour day is a normal day for us. And that's what you expect. But when you go to 16, 18 hour days, no, that's where having someone, a middleman, is always going to benefit everyone.
Talk to me about the background check process. There's so many instances where like old racist tweets are unearthed, like in the case of those guys on Vanderpump Rules. Of course, Jen Shah, and then that ladders up to like actual federal offenses like like Jen Shah. At first, it seemed like there wasn't even a social media background check. If like those tweets are just linked, like what do you attribute that to?
We as casting producers are responsible for doing what we call level one. Level one is like literally scan the internet, what comes up, do a little digging, look on Facebook, but don't spend days and days. And you know, oh, she's pretty clean. You know, sometimes if I'm doing a show, certainly if you had pornography in your background, that was a deal breaker, but it's not anymore. The minute they cast, got $1 million listing New York. What's his name?
Frederick.
Then all bets were off, like the audience didn't care. Now, a level two, level three is where they'll hire someone, social security number, find out if you have any felony convictions. One thing I will say is you don't have to tell me anything. I don't want to know. But if you've had a felony misdemeanor, spousal abuse, anything like that, don't even call me back and I'll get it, you know, because you're not going to get on the show.
So what do you attribute to like those old racist tweets or things on Facebook will resurface?
I am not a fan of cancel culture. I think you have to take things on a case-by-case basis. Some people are young, some people are stupid. But usually it's the network's decision. You know, we'll say, here's what they're like, okay, well, let's decide. And very often, I'm not made aware because it's a legal thing. So they're like, so-and-so's not going to be on the show, and that's all we can talk about. So once it gets up to the deeper levels of background, I'm usually not privy to it because they don't want to get sued for, you know, giving people's information out. And they're very tight-lipped about it.
In the case of something like Jen Shah,
okay,
who is the single point of failure there?
I guess, I mean, if she was running a legitimate business and it seemed legit to Bravo, I mean, she has a business. I mean, who found out? Like, I don't think it's their job to dig deep and find out if she's a crook. You know? Yeah. I think that probably, her victims came forward after she was on the show. Now, right. I guess the question is, when do you pull someone? Should they pull her mid-season? Because these charges are out there. I'm not going to fault anyone, you know, for choosing who to keep on, who not. Like Erika Jayne's a perfect example because some people say, how could she not know? I'm like, I don't know. I'm not in her head. I'm not walking in her shoes. So is it right to take her off before people know? Because they don't. And you know what? She wouldn't be the first woman or man who was in a relationship that really didn't know how the money was coming in. I do believe that happens a lot.
You did casting for, I believe, 4 seasons of The Millionaire Matchmaker with Patty Stanger.
So 4, yeah.
What can you tell me about this experience?
That was a great learning experience, too, because I was very green. That was a tough show. It was, people were passionate about how they were presented. I was in charge of finding that season. The first season, I was in charge of finding the daters. So it was tough because, if you know, if you remember the show, Patty would have a millionaire and an alleged millionaire.
Yeah, I want to talk about the fact that Millionaire Matchmaker, meanwhile, Leah McSweeney from Housewives was the quote unquote millionaire when she was literally like, I don't know, 25. So
if you can prove on paper that you're a millionaire, you count for the show. So if you have a deed to a house or you're a partial owner, whatever, and you have real estate, which a lot of people do, family stuff, You are a millionaire. And so it's legit. It was hard. It was finding the girls to show up. I mean, if they needed to see 10 people, we had to book 25 because people don't show up at the last minute. They do get paid an extras fee, but it was real. They were going to go out on dates and there were a lot of women that were passionate about it. And people might remember, is a really famous episode. People might remember Josie Goldberg. She's kind of well-known in reality TV world. She had been on a prior episode before I started working on it. So when I started working on the show, they said to me, I think we want someone to crash the meet and greet this week when Patty meets the, you know, whatever, or crash the social. So I'm like, well, this girl, Josie Goldberg. Oh, send Josie. We know her. So I'm like, okay, send Josie. Josie showed up and crashed the party, and evidently it was great TV. Patty wasn't happy, and she said to Josie, I told you no. And then Josie said, just give me another chance. And Josie went at her. It was really funny. I didn't know it, being new. Patty was not happy. Production shut down. I thought I was going to get fired. Cut to a couple weeks later, I had to go on set after having cast the daters, when Patty has to pick the girls. And she was not happy that day. And she let me know it and everybody there. Patty Stanger. It was real nice. The minute the cameras rolled, she was not happy. And it was And anyone who's seen the show has seen her do this. These girls are hideous. I'm not working with these women. That was real. She was not faking that. But then she turned it on me, which was a little bit odd because I'm not on camera. Who the hell are you? I've told these producers, gay people shouldn't work on shows for straight people. Gay people for gay shows and straight people. Oh, oh my and I remember, oh yeah, oh yeah. Then she comes back and she's screaming in the control room. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like about a year later when that episode, when that season was premiering, she was on one of the morning shows and someone said, it was Jillian Barbieri, Good Day LA. Patty, you're known for your opinions and you're, you know, have you ever gone too far? She goes, well, I don't think so. Well, no, you know, I take that back. I may have once with the producer, but I'm not allowed to talk about it.
Oh, wow.
And I'll leave you with this. I didn't think, I was so new. I thought this happens all the time to people. I don't know, a year or two later, I was at some like industry party and we were talking and I told someone that story and they went, that was you? That story went around. So evidently it was kind of, and I think maybe people cleaned up the behavior, which was a good thing maybe.
What was your biggest fuck up as a casting producer?
Oh boy, let's see. I remember it was the one that was sort of a parody of the Housewives and they're especially rich women. And for some reason, none of us thought to check to see these women really were as rich as they said they were. That show sold and we all went, we found out that none of them had, like, they weren't rich. So we had to like get fake facades and like get like new locations to like make it appear. That was pretty bad.
Can you give us a hint as to what show this is?
It was on the Style Network and it was for 4 seasons.
It ran for 4 seasons?
So the show was highly rated. It was on the same time as Jerseylicious, if you remember that.
You also cast The People's Couch. Of course, I'm thinking of like Julie Goldman and Brandi Howard.
Shot Julie and Brandi. I was the first person to put them on tape.
Emerson Collins. Okay, so talk about this. Like, how did you?
That was an interesting story. That was one of my favorite projects. I was hired to come on that team to shoot what they call a proof of concept reel. Proof of concept means the network is not 100% sold on picking it up. So they want to see, okay, prove to me that this show can go. Proof of concept.
Even though it was a huge hit overseas called Gogglebox. I know, it
doesn't matter. Is the U.S. audience going to buy this? Mm-hmm. So they wanted to see the pairings, the couplings. And so I and some other producers were tasked with going out and finding, apart from that part, finding people. Do you remember the Egberts, the people, the family that watched TV in bed?
Yes, of course, yeah.
I remember, because I would go to their house like, how do you watch TV? How do you do it? And they're like, well, we watch TV in bed every night. And like, that's how we're going to
shoot. But where did they come from?
They probably applied. We put out casting flyers. It was right after the Red Wedding on Game of Thrones. That's how I know the year, because we had a video of like maybe a 30-minute video of clips from all the shows that were popular that summer. So whatever the Red Wedding was, and I would play it at their house and then shoot them talking about it. So the network would say, oh, okay, they're good. The Egberts, I'll never forget. I shot them in bed. And when I came back, my boss was, that's so weird. I'm like, yeah, but well, guess what? They got on the show watching TV in bed.
Take me into the casting of Julie and Brandi.
Julie and Brandi, again, they were already, I didn't find them. They were already found. We wanted lots of comedians, obviously. So we shot a lot of couples and they were just a no-brainer. I mean, they were just literally just hit record and we knew they were.
I actually worked with them. I used to write for this website and we used to do a lot of video content with them where they would do movie reviews. These are all still on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And the bit was that they hated every movie. In fact, they did Sex and the City too. They did Black Swan and they would like, Julie would like dress up, they would like recreate the movie and then they would like shit talk it like in their backyard.
And well, that's what we all do. And that's like, yeah. You said, that's what I loved about that show. I don't know why it didn't go more seasons. I know one interesting story was they wanted the very sort of Bravo type gay men, and they did have, the three guys.
They had Emerson Collins, his boyfriend, yes, and their other friend. But it's Emerson and Blake and then their friend.
Yes. They were great, but it was so hard because me being from a different generation, I had some guys I loved that were so great. But, it being the Bravo show, Bravo picked who they knew their audience. You can't get emotionally connected to your stories because at the end of the day, it's Bravo show and it's their decision.
Did you see the announcement for this new, there's going to be a new reality show, they're trying to like kind of do the A-list New York again with this real, it's like Real Friends of WeHo. And it's like a group of gay guys. It's Todrick Hall, Brad Goreski, the guy from Mean Girls, like his husband. What do you think of a show like this where clearly every person cast already has quite a big following, like millions of followers in the case of Brad Goreski?
I mean, it's a crapshoot. No one knows what's going to hit. My feeling is the best TV comes from people that you don't anticipate. These are all performers, actors, seasoned TV people. They're so conscious of their public persona already that I can't imagine you're going to get the kind of TV, the viewers that, and who's airing it, do you know?
MTV.
Yeah, that's a tough sell, I think, from my perspective. But listen, they know what they're doing, and I wish them well. I just don't think they're not MTV's demographic.
They're airing it right after Drag Race.
We know it's interesting. I just did a project, the MTV's partnering with Smithsonian. So maybe MTV's branching out because it's a competition show with very, very well-known established contemporary artists called The Exhibit. I believe it's premiering in March. So that makes me think MTV, good for them. They're probably trying to expand their demo because the guys you mentioned are not going to speak to Gen Z or maybe even millennials, but maybe they will. You know, if you're good producers, you can make, you know, you can make, I said, give me great characters and we'll find a show.
Did you watch that show Finding Prince Charming on Logo? It was the gay bachelor show hosted by Lance Bass. The main guy, Robert Sepulveda Jr., it was found out that he was basically an escort.
I do remember this. I think now it'll be different because people have a very different take on sex workers.
Here's what's interesting about that. So this new show, The Real Friends of WeHo, which I think is such a lame title, by the way.
It's so bad. Let me stop you because the reason I stopped because I do know someone that was producing a similar show. And I remember thinking, I've been down this road. I've been tasked. You cannot break into the LA gay list, the real LA gay list. They're like, not going to do it. So they always get these sort of also rans. And anyway, so I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. Talk more about that.
No, I remember someone called me and I said, here's what you're going to do. I've been asked to do this. I know these people. I mean, they thought they were going to get David Geffen and David. These, no, they're not. There's no questions asked. No, I'll watch it, Frank, but there's no way I'm going to go on that show. So then you get the people that know the people. Blah, blah, blah. So it just was one of those things that was, you can find the housewives. You feel, for some reason, you're not going to find gay men in LA that live at a certain level that are willing to go on reality TV. It's just not going to happen. Those gates were locked.
I would argue that the housewives themselves, they're exactly what you just described. You're never going to get, for example, right? They were trying to recast the Real Housewives of New York, or even like the problems they've had in the past casting Beverly Hills. You're not going to find the actual upper echelon of, say, the Upper East Side. There is no way in hell that they are going to go on a reality show. So then you are going to cast reality adjacent people, like a Jenna Lyons who has done reality television before. She's a name. And then you can get people who know the real people, but you're not going to get people who have like actual kids in school, people with something to really lose. Like if they're on the board of directors of, say, XYZ charity, I just don't think that they are going, people with a real reputation.
Absolutely. Most of those people probably wouldn't make good TV. So it's a trade-off. Are we going to go for the real deal? We're going to give us a boring show, or people that might be one or two rungs down that are going to have fabulous TV. And I can tell you what the viewer wants to see. The viewer wants fantasy. I don't care if they're really rich. I want to see them go at it like cats in a bag.
When this announcement came out about The Real Friends of WeHo, my first thought was, oh, they're casting Brad Goreski because they're, well, first of all, he has a history on Bravo. And also they're thinking, oh, maybe Gary Jannetty will make a cameo. And the same thing with Jonathan Bennett's husband. They're like, oh, maybe we'll get Jonathan Bennett. I'm sure that's got to be part of it. They want to see him.
Absolutely. And they're friends. And it's, I mean, from my experience, it almost never happens. But then I hear Martina Navratilova is in the Real Housewives of Miami. But, you know,
I mean, Harry Hamlin did Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. So like fucking anything can happen. Let me ask you a question. Why are there some shows, like there was a show on, it was either, I think it was also on Logo. It was airing right after Finding Prince Charming, called Fire Island. This was produced by Kelly Ripa and Mark Consuelos. And the casting was so fucked up because they weren't even casting actual New Yorkers. The people who rent summer shares in Fire Island are New Yorkers. Instead, they went and found, they used a production company that was, I guess, based in LA. And all of these people were living in LA, not actually connected to the New York social world or the New York gay social world. How does something like that get so fucked up in casting?
That's up to the producers. I mean, one of the characters in that show, I think, used it as a springboard to do a porn career. I don't want to slag off anybody, because I know they worked really hard on that show, and some people were passionate and really nice people wanted to see it happen. It didn't. Most shows fail. You know, it's that, you know, the shows that swim, you're like, okay, what do we do? Any producer will tell you, give me a season 2, 3, and 4 show any day. It's this first season so hard because you're inventing the wheel. Season 2, 3, 4, especially when it involves a lot of casting, great. But then after season 4, the network's going, well, we've seen these stories and how about, and we call it the unicorn. They always want the unicorn, the person who has to have this, and things trend. After 9/11, everyone wanted a 9/11 story, you know, and then, you know, we don't want that. We've seen that. So after season 4 or 5 reality shows, it gets harder and harder to cast, like Below Deck. After a while, you know, a deckhand's a deckhand, a deckhand. You know, I mean, you're going to find a 25-year-old kid. And the other thing is that show's hard because they have to have experience.
So you also worked on 3 or 4 seasons of Tabitha's Takeover. And you even worked on the originating show, Sheer Genius, which I loved. Tell me about working on Tabitha's show.
Okay. Tabitha is, I love her. We're still in contact. I think
she lives in Jersey.
Yes. She just got it. She played a character on TV that was harsh, critical, judgmental, but that's why she got her spinoff. People might not remember, she didn't even win Sheer Genius, but she was the fan favorite. So again, I came on after that to do a proof of concept reel. Is Tabitha going to be able to do her own show? So I ran around LA and all these salons that would have been worthy of a makeover. I'll never forget when we were doing recruiting. Every January, Tabitha and I would have to go to the ICE show, which was the big national hair show in Long Beach. And I said, I swear to God, walking through that room with Tabitha would have been what I would think it would feel like going at the time with Madonna to a gay bar. I mean, she was a rock star. And she understood what she did. She played a part on TV that wasn't necessarily who she was in real life. If you know what I mean, she was a doll. She probably wouldn't like me saying that. I think her personality on camera came through the way it did because she was passionate about her career. And she really got on people. If you didn't have respect for this career that I've worked my ass off in, you know, if you're going to be dirty and you're going to be sloppy and lazy, don't call yourself a hairstylist. Go do something else. So that's where the passion came in. But she was unlike other people I've worked with behind the scenes. She was delightful and she was very eager to see this, you know, to work with the producers to make a great show rather than being a detriment to production. Tabitha, I can't say enough good things about her. And
that's
I would love to see her back on TV again. She's been through a lot of stuff in her life now because, you know, they morphed her into doing more sort of all types of businesses, family owned businesses. And then I think she did a life coaching show. And I know she's been through some stuff recently and it would be great to see Tabitha again.
She does life coaching stuff now. I do. I swear. I think you can book, because I interviewed her a while back and and in researching that, it's like, oh, you can book time with Tabitha to solve your life.
I can't imagine what producers go through with once these housewives are successful. So I'm back in school getting a degree at Temple University. But I'm still working. I still work all the time.
Well, I was going to ask, are you do you still want to do casting on the side, freelance?
Yeah, no, I do casting all the time. But, you know, I'm at a certain age now where, you know, I do want to do other things. I do some writing. I'm interested in doing more producing. I just shot a couple commercials. I won an award last year I worked for the Lincoln Project. Equivalent of the Oscars for political advertising. It's called the Ollie.
Frank Garrity, thank you so much. This is so fun.
Yes, it was delightful. I hope I made you proud.
No, this was great. Thanks so much for listening. You can follow me, JessXNYC, across all social media, Instagram, and definitely subscribe to the YouTube channel that is Hot Takes and Deep Dives, and my name, Jess Rothschild, where you can watch videos of all of these interviews.